Five and go.
Okay, I'm recording.
I got dots.
Yeah, I got dots too. And
then what was the other thing I needed to do? Oh, I need to switch this over so you can hear the music. Please.
That would be good. Please. Motivation to begin with.
Okay, you can still hear me. Yes.
I can.
Still yes.
Hear all right, you. Good. So you'll be able to hear the music too. You ready?
So is it me or is it my eyes that the orange dots get bigger and there's like extra rows? Or am I do not need glasses with my contacts.
If you see big dots, then
they get bigger as you talk. They're like,
yes, they do get bigger as you talk. Yeah, they're okay. Up and down.
Okay.
They're up and down.
That's the idea.
They didn't do that before. They were just there and moving. I thought I was losing my eyesight or something.
Nope, they go up and down.
Oh, you may have your voice. Changed setting. It doesn't really matter.
Yes.
Okay. As long as the proper USB microphone is selected and the recorder is rolling, we'll be good.
That's all what right. Matters most.
But, let's just pick the first thing on the list. How's that?
Go.
Okay, there we go.
And welcome to the Higher Things Simulcast. This is a highly organized, daringly Lutheran train wreck of a podcast. I am Sandra Ostapowicz, and I'm here with Pastor Donovan Riley.
I had too much butter pecan gelato for dinner.
And Pastor Christopher Gillespie, picking our music, producing the show.
Yeah, randomly, but picking the music. Yeah, we should remind people about the social media stuff. Right?
We should.
Okay.
Hey.
Yeah, haven't done that for a bit.
Do that, Mr. Producer.
All right. You can reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/HTSimulcast. Twitter at, HTSimulcast as well. And higherthings.org/resources/simulcast. Lots of ways. Find us on iTunes. Please rate and review. And post your comments or suggestions at higherthings.org/contact. There you go.
Thank all right. You.
Yeah, go back and just replay it if you missed anything.
we're everywhere.
Everywhere.
The Google. So, use the Google.
Use the Google. Yes. So, what are we talking about today?
What are we? You know, it's. I was looking at this yesterday. Every like 2 or 3 months, I go through this phase where I swear off reading theology. And because I've kind of a couple of years ago, about 4 years ago, I hit kind of the 10,000 hour mark, the 10,000 hour rule that I had read, got to the point where I realized I'd read the same book about the Lord's Supper just by different authors, and that it had just become redundant, reading more, you know, reading books on the Lord's Supper over and over, you know, by different authors, same conversation. And I got, I don't know, I wouldn't say frustrated, but I just got kind of made me step back and reassess, you know, what I read and why I read. And then every couple of months, like I said, I'll just swear off and I'll go back to reading fiction. I'll start reading novels. I'll start reading comic books and do that to loosen up my mind. And then inevitably I look at my Kindle library and I'm reading 7 theology books again at the same time. Part of this, I think, is just the fault of Amazon for making it so easy for me to buy books.
I understand that problem.
Like I'm pathologically impulsive when it comes to buying. I'm like, oh, a book. But the other side of it, too, is that at this point, for me anyways, at this point in my readings, I get bored really quickly with theology in the sense of I've read so much that I can usually tell by the end of the introduction or first chapter where the author is going with his thesis or where the direction is going. And I tend to say, okay, you know, I know where you're going. I've read this before. You know, I know what your argument's going to be up front. I'm not going to read this. I'll go read something else. And So I was looking at my library of books that I'm reading right now, and I keep going back to my favorites, my Luther, my Hermann Saze, my Norman Nagel, and I read those all the time. I can't not. I always pick them up and read them. But I find myself more and more, both pastorally and as a Christian, seeking out good writers, writers that are just good at their craft of writing and are engaging as authors, so that more and more, I find that I read authors' theological writings that I disagree with, but I read them because the author is engaging me with both their style as a writer and with the readability of the book or the article. And I find that, and here we go, buckle up, kids. I find that amongst my colleagues in the LCMS, for example, that we have there's a particular way of writing about theology that has a particular tone and style that's very dry or dogmatic and not engaging. And I would even say, for me anyways, boring, that the theology is exciting. The plot or the theme or the topic is relevant and vital, but the way in which it's presented is boring. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Sure. No.
And that's the podcast.
Okay.
Come back for another 24 minutes next week.
No. And I mean, I have a similar problem that, you know, I get bored and I always keep at least one fiction book going, usually on audiobook, because that's just how I like to listen to my fiction, or things that are more entertaining than they are challenging.
Right.
And, I've got a stack of books that I'm trying to read, but, you know, life gets in the way a lot for me, and I don't have time to think about what I'm reading as much as I would like to. So I don't get to read as much of the heavier things that I would like to, and, you know, to finish my PhD that I kind of need to do. But it's really easy, though, to... Like, we surround ourselves with like-minded people who we already agree with on most things. We surround ourselves with resources and texts that we also already agree with that may challenge us in an occasional nuance, but they aren't really challenging us at the very, you know, the very ground foundational level of things. And I think that's good for a person to be challenged, I mean, not to always be in an echo chamber. Of whether it's, you know, people telling you, yes, you know, we all agree and we're all the same and that kind of thing, or the books that you're reading, the things that you're taking in. I think we need to have, we can't just surround ourselves with everyone and everything that we already agree with.
Yeah. Well,
that's not healthy.
And to the point too, we talked about what social, we often talk about the negative aspects of social media or how they can be used negatively, or social media, the internets, how social media be used negatively to discourage engagement or discourage conversation. But for myself anyways, what social media has opened up is that I can engage authors that I read now, that once I got past my own hang up about contacting someone who wrote a book, and I can't talk to them, they wrote a book. And then you contact them and they're, you know, they're just laboring away.
They're just a person?
No, they're just a person, and they have a life, and they have kids, and they're on their way to a, you know, a school meeting, and they call you back, and they want to talk because they're excited that you read their book or their article, and you want to engage them on the topic, because they're excited, obviously. They wrote about
it. Wait, because they're people, too?
They're people at the other end of the book. I know, it's crazy.
See, I think that's something we just in general, we forget that, you know, we read things online, whether it's, you know, blogs or social media posts or books, you know, actual paper and binding books, and forget that these are real people with real lives going on and real thoughts and emotions and all these kinds of things. They're not just kind of an abstract author.
Right.
But that's an actual person that you can, if they're still living, potentially engage with. And that's kind of cool.
Right. I never let that stop me from engaging Luther in a conversation, but that's another podcast.
Well, I think there's medicines for that.
I think there's actually a book called Conversations with Martin Luther or something. I think Timothy Lowell wrote it before he died. But when I engage authors on the topics they're writing about, and more nowadays, because I am a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pastor, and that's a constant conversation. I talk with friends of ours at Irvine all the time, Concordia Irvine, like Scott Keith and Jeff Melanson and those guys, or other pastors or laity. It's the same thing with social media. They can contact me or call me on the phone and we can talk and kind of carry on that conversation. But I also notice, and this goes back to my point too, is when I first became a Christian, I read everything I could get my hands on about Christianity, for example. I read a lot of C.S. Lewis. That really piqued my interest, reading like Mere Christianity. And then through that, I started reading the Screwtape Letters. And then I read the Paralandra series he wrote, the kind of sci-fi fantasy novels he wrote. And then I just read everything that C.S. Lewis wrote because he just excited me. Because here was a guy who, he kind of grew up in the Church of England, kind of, but then, you know, his whole story of kind of becoming an atheist and coming back into the faith. And I just read everything I could. And I didn't really have a filter. I didn't really step back and say, well, I'm not going to read that Christian because reasons. I just read whatever I could get my hands on because it was really exciting for me to just like drown in that pool because it was new. Mm-hmm. And when I went to seminary, after I went to seminary, I lost that excitement because I wasn't drowning, you know, in the pool anymore. I was drowned, you know, spending hours and hours and hours reading technical books, really, and reading everything of Luther I could get my hands on, and then reading everything in Lutheran history I could get my hands on, everything about church history for my PhD that I could get my hands on. And I came out of my MDiv and my PhD unexcited about the Christian faith, unexcited about theology. It was my job, and I treated it like a job.
I totally understand that, how that happens. It happened to me when I was, you know, going through grad school and all of that kind of thing too. And I can see it happening to other people who are in the schools that produce people like that. It happens very commonly to young pastors and to seminarians, and that's a good thing, that they should be completely immersed in what they're studying, because that's going to be their calling, Lord willing. Right. And they do need to be prepared, and that is how you get prepared for it. But it also can't replace...
Experience
and the interactions that you have and the conversations that you have about what you're reading and discussing and talking things through. Yeah. Everyone processes information in different ways, learning styles and all that kind of thing. But, you know, actually engaging with other people is really helpful. I mean, that was a basic thing I learned in high school, composition class, that you take the best arguments that are against what you have to say, the very best, not the weakest, the best.
Right.
And if you can't shoot those down,
that's a good point.
Satisfactorily, you really don't have anything to say because you have to be that prepared. And if you're only getting, you know, the caricature of opposing ideas and dealing with, you know, straw men, then your arguments, unbeknownst to you, are going to be sounding really weak. And in your positions then, too.
What happens when you narrow down your library of theologians, your library of authors, to those who affirm or basically thicken the concrete below your feet for what you already believe? Because I know I think all of us in some way, shape, or form, even if you say, you know, my favorite novelist is Cormac McCarthy or my favorite novelist is Flannery O'Connor, there's going to be someone who says, I hate Cormac McCarthy and here's why.
Right.
And you shouldn't read Cormac McCarthy because. And then they give you their reasons. And rather than searching or exploring for those authors or those writers that, like you said, stimulate you, engage you, and present you with a picture of humanity, if it's a novelist, or a picture of theology or a picture of philosophy or whatever it might be, that challenges you to think through your presuppositions or think through what you already believe to be true or that you like to read or whatever it might be, that you say, well, I'm not going to read outside of what I already know is going to make me feel good, affirm my position, make me feel, you know, basically reinforce I'm right.
Oh, who doesn't like to hear that they're right? I mean, those are my favorite words to hear. I was wrong. You were right, Sandra. Oh. That's my favorite thing. No, but it's if we can't do it with what we're reading for whatever reason, like, you know, I just don't have time to read the things that I want to read right now. Mm-hmm. I can at least engage with people who don't agree with me. And something that kind of popped in my head as you were talking is that, you know, as much as people want to decry, you know, we're transitioning into a postmodern culture and mm-hmm. and the horrible things that come with postmodernity and mm-hmm. and all of that. One thing that is interesting, I think, is the love of narrative that is rising. Because we got into very much into the technical how-to manuals and like you said, the dry kind of dogmatic kind of transmitting of information. And that's not the way it's always been. I mean, the Bible itself was stories. There is stories being told. And that was how, you know, the story of Christ came to us from even before he was born. And now the narrative, the storytelling is coming back. And I think it's so important that I think that's a good thing to embrace, because the storytellers are the ones who hold history, who hold the information.
Right.
And we need to become storytellers of what we believe and think and confess, especially in the church, because that's how we engage so much with people.
Well, that's an interesting point that you make, because some of my favorite podcasts are history podcasts, and going back, and for those who don't know, before modernity, before the Enlightenment, history was a part of literature. It was a part of the humanities. Mm-hmm. So if you read Herodotus, for example, and you read the history of the Peloponnesian Wars, which are fascinating to me, you could take a chapter after chapter after chapter and just make a TV series out of the histories that Herodotus writes or Thucydides writes, because it's narrative, it's literature, it's investigating eyewitnesses or people who heard the story from their mothers or grandmothers, and then it was passed on to the historian who was collecting this information to publish it. And those stories, those narratives were first spoken out loud, and then written down and recorded and published later. But that since prehistory, we communicate through stories. We communicate through narrative, through anecdotes. And that what happened with modernity is history was all of a sudden kind of sucked into the sciences, as so many other disciplines were. So that, unfortunately, history was kind of held up to the scientific method of proof, you know, whether it's true or not. And so that's where you get things in the 20th century, like scholars saying, well, we're not sure King David was a real guy. Maybe he was more like King Arthur, or maybe he's like a whole bunch of kings kind of, you know, glommed together. We're not really sure the story about Jericho is true, or Sodom and Gomorrah, because it's so fantastic. And then archaeologists dig up stuff and go, no, it's true. The walls fell.
It was there.
You know, we found Sodom and Gomorrah. It's at the bottom of the ocean here, or the Dead Sea. This Assyrian tablet has King David's name on it, as if, you know, as if these are historical. But, you know, to your point, the entire Old Testament is narrative theology for the most part, other than, you know, the poetry stuff, or Psalms, Proverbs, wisdom literature. It's primarily narrative. And this goes back to my original point, is that narrative engages me, and a good writer, a good communicator engages me and excites me to read. It excites my imagination. It fires my imagination. It causes me to start thinking. One of my newer acquaintances that I've met has done a lot of work in writing a book on homosexuality, the biblical understanding of marriage, the biblical understanding of same-sex attraction, what the Bible does say and what it doesn't say, what our presuppositions have kind of taught us the Bible says versus what it actually says. And it's been fascinating to have that conversation with him, because he's fired my imagination again. It got me mm-hmm. excited to think on that topic, to talk about that topic, so that rather than treating it like a blind alley and saying it's either this or that, he's challenged me to go back into the Bible and to go back through all those passages in the Old and New Testaments that we hold up against or for same-sex attraction. And the same way with other authors, it's just those authors aren't Lutheran for the most part, or they're not LCMS Lutheran. And like I said, it's not that I agree with them theologically. It's that they are good writers, they're good communicators, and they fire my imagination. They stimulate me to go to the Bible. Because when I read Luther, for example, I don't have a lot of filters on with Luther, because I've lived with him for 20 years. And with other theologians like Saze or Nagel, I don't have to put up filters when I read them because I know I'm going to agree with them because they're the ones who taught me my sacramental theology, or they're the ones who taught me how to teach the catechism or mm-hmm. how to preach. And yet, because I don't put up filters when I read them, sometimes I'll go over things that they erred on, or that they weren't right on, or that I might mm-hmm. disagree with mm-hmm. biblically. So for myself, anyways, in the present tense, like I said, reading non-Lutheran authors, one, stimulates and fires my imagination, kind of drives me back into the Bible. Second, they're available to me. I can communicate with them through social media or on the phone. I can go to conferences and talk with them or engage them. And that, I think, is something that we have now in the present tense that wasn't available even 15 years ago, mm-hmm. really. And I think that provides us a wonderful opportunity. I just also see the opposite, which is, like we talked about in the last podcast, you know, we create subcultures and subdivisions within our denomination, and each mm-hmm. denomination does it. Each church does that. They create these subdivisions.
Sinful nature. That's what we do.
Right. And so we narrow it down to, well, you're assigned to this group because these are the authors you read, and this is your what you think is most important, and these are the doctrines you cling to as being the most important. And then this group over here, they go and they read theirs, their authors, their theology, and this is their doctrine that they hold up as being primary. And then we just hurl insults or accusations back and forth at each other of mm-hmm. not being Orthodox, not being Lutheran enough, not being, you know, this enough, not being, you know. And so rather than engage authors, not only authors within our church body that we may agree or disagree with, but engaging authors outside our church body, it seems to me that there's almost this inherent prejudice in a church body when it narrows down the conversation to, we will only read what we agree with and we only talk to the extent that we agree with each other. Outside of that, we're going to start making divisions again. It's going to be an us and them kind of situation. Because I speak anecdotally. Someone I'm acquainted with, and we cross paths, is Nadia Boltz-Weber. And she's an ELCA, whatever you want to call her. She's a hot point. And yet I'm fascinated by Nadia. Because one, she's Gen X, so she's got the snark and the sarcasm. She's got, you know, she's got a very similar personal history to me. I've often been referred to as Donovan Boltz-Weber by people. And that's fine. It's funny. And the reason that I engage Nadia, though, is because, one, I'm fascinated by how she planted her church. I'm fascinated by how she came back into the faith. And I want to understand what it is that draws people to her. Because it's not that she's pandering to, like, the lowest common denominator. She's not. And I'm fascinated by that because I want to know what draws people to someone who is openly a biblical revisionist and yet liturgical, knows Luther backwards and forwards, but ain't real big on the atonement. And so and yet she's available to me to engage and read and have a conversation with. And I don't see anything wrong with engaging someone that you disagree with in a way that's non-confrontational.
Actually, it can actually be a really fun experience for everyone involved. I mean, it really can. You can both learn from each other and realize that you're both people and you know, agree on what you agree on and don't agree on what you don't agree on. And that's okay. You don't have to agree on everything. We're not cookie cutters.
Well, it's funny, too, because, again, anecdotally, she broke one direction and I broke the other direction when we both came back into the church around the same time.
Sure.
And that fascinates me to go, how did you make the decision to go left instead of right? Because I went right and not left.
Hard right,
hard right. Well, I went to the ELCA seminary.
Right.
And, the reason I went to an ELCA seminary is because I applied to an LCMS seminary and they wanted me to be sober 10 years before I applied to seminary. And at the time, my professor said, go study in the ELCA seminary. And I didn't know the difference at that point, really, between the ELCA and the LCMS. I'd only been in the LCMS 2 years. So I went. And when I got to the ELCA seminary, it didn't take me long before I realized, well, this is definitely not the same as the church that I left out in Portland, Oregon, or Concordia, Portland, and the theological conversations we had there. And there's there's not a chance that I'm going to stay in the ELCA. Now, there was a time when I just hated everything that was ELCA. Like, kind of like going through a really ugly divorce.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and coming out the side going, I hate everybody who likes my ex-wife. Whereas now, I realize that that was just my personal stuff. That was my personal, you know, hang-ups. And now I have those conversations with people in the ELCA, both at the seminary and outside in the community. Now, they know who I am. I'm coming from the LCMS. They know who I am. And yet, and
right.
I know
there's
who they
no
are.
There's no pretension.
So,
yeah.
Right. There's no pretense. And so we can have a conversation because all of our cards are on the table. Mm-hmm. It's like when I talk with my friend who's a Reformed professor, Old Testament professor. Now, we both know we disagree on baptism and the Lord's Supper. That's on the table. Like, we don't have to sit here and hash that out. We're going to have a conversation about the Old Testament. And he wrote a book. I read the book. He's read my blog. He's read my articles. He's listened to me do presentations. I've listened to his presentations. And so we both know when it comes to baptism, that's another conversation for another time.
Right.
Because we're not going to agree. But what we really want to talk about right now is we want to talk about Genesis.
Sure.
So that's what we're going to talk about.
Right. And that such a conversation can take place. We don't have to drive everything by, you know, those points that we disagree on. To make sure we hammer those out and are in full agreement before we can agree with anything else that someone else says.
Mm-hmm.
We can say, I really like this part of what this person talks about. I think this is really good. I think this is something we can learn from. Like you said, it's driving me back to the scriptures. It's challenging my brain and see what the scriptures really said. And you know what happens a lot with non-Lutheran authors is that they can be really, really good up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And that point tends to be where the sacraments hit in.
Exactly.
And what we can do then as Lutherans is build upon that, take what they've done that's good, and fill in the missing part of the sacraments, and have this really wonderful, beautiful confession to put out there to that'll resonate with even more people because it's coming from a different point. Right. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes with some more Higher Things simulcast for you. How's that? Or a couple minutes, couple days. We'll be back soon with some more simulcast for you.